A new report on death penalty cases in Pennsylvania finds a strong tie between how a case develops and the type of legal counsel representing defendants. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports, experts say the report highlights chronic problems with the state's criminal justice system.
The study found that public defenders' clients are more likely to be convicted in death penalty cases that make it to trial. But before the trial stage, prosecutors are more likely to abandon their pursuit of the death penalty and less likely to seek it in the first place against defendants represented by public defenders. Lizette McCormick says that's not necessarily a good thing either. She runs the Interbranch Commission for Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Fairness, which partnered on the study with Penn State.
If they take a plea, that's not necessarily a better outcome, only because many of the public defenders and court-appointed attorneys as well have limited resources. So there may be an increased opportunity for the defendant to plead to something. There may not be enough evidence to convict him of.
But McCormick doesn't know for sure because the report doesn't detail the case's earlier stages. As it was, the study took over 3 years and required researchers to go beyond reported data and review case files in courthouses all over the state. Rob Dunham formerly headed the Philadelphia Defenders Association and led defense teams focused on capital murder cases involving indigent defendants in Philly and in Harrisburg.
The Penn State study shows that the very same problems that have been left ignored for the last 30 years continue to exist and continue to ensure we're going to have a continuing charade. People who are sentenced to death are not going to be executed. Their death sentences are going to be overturned. And we can have no confidence in the outcome of capital proceedings because from the outset, they're unfair.
Dunham, now executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, says this system not only breeds injustice, but also wastes money. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
On November 7th, Pennsylvania voters will consider a constitutional amendment that could lead to radical changes in how the state funds public schools. Or it could do nothing. Keystone Crossroads contributor Avi Wolfman-Aaron breaks down a proposal riddled with uncertainty.
Let's start with the basics. If this amendment passes, the state could eliminate property taxes on residences and farms. And property taxes are the main way local school districts raise money. Now, that change sounds drastic, but
this is not a now things are going to change tomorrow proposition.
Jay Himes is executive director of the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials.
This is, again, another option to consider in a statewide property tax relief proposal.
That's because this amendment doesn't require the state to do anything. So there's a lot of mystery around what would happen if voters approve it. Some believe it could tee up legislation that would totally abolish residential property taxes. And that's music to the ears of Schuylkill County's David Argel. The Republican state senator sponsored a tax elimination bill that nearly passed the Senate in 2015.
We're so close, but we still don't have the votes we need. That's why we need to change the Constitution.
With the amendment, Harrisburg could craft a bill that eliminates property taxes for homeowners but still taxes businesses. Argel thinks that could win him a few more allies. But some folks like property taxes. From a school funding perspective, they're stable and reliable. Plus, getting rid of them would jack up other taxes, possibly sales and income taxes. Argel's proposal would also do nothing to smooth out the vast inequities that exist between rich and poor school districts.
It's clearly wrongheaded.
Donna Cooper is executive director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth and opposes the amendment.
We should be looking to reduce property taxes for those who are most stressed and increase the state share of funding for our schools so that we decrease the pressure on homeowners.
But again, this amendment wouldn't necessarily lead to total tax elimination. It could, for instance, allow lawmakers to set up a system where poor residents with runaway property taxes get some relief. No one really knows, which means this vote has big implications, but little clarity. Avi Wolfman-Aaron for Keystone Crossroads.
Philadelphia is equipping all of the city's patrol officers with body cameras over the next 4 years. It's a move celebrated by reformers and police alike as a step toward greater accountability. But as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, city officials used an unusual process for completing the deal, and that has other body camera companies saying the city is playing favorites.
This story starts in 2014.
In the aftermath of Ferguson, this question caught fire. Should every cop in America wear a body camera? Amplifying that debate, the deaths of Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Sandra Blair.
Shortly after this, Philly joined the body camera movement by launching a pilot program. Officers in North Philly were testing out an array of cameras in the field, including some from Taser. When officials expanded the pilot, they bought more cameras from Taser. They did this without asking others to compete, and that was controversial. Now, documents obtained by WHYY show that the city has given Taser a $12.5 million deal to provide 4,000 patrol cops with body cameras. They won the business with no competition.
We felt that it was being... It was all roads were leading to Taser.
Ellen Madelman Kaplan is the city's chief integrity officer. She admits this deal might not look great. Here's why. Usually when big-dollar city contracts are handed out, companies compete with one another and the lowest bidder wins. Since this is taxpayer money we're talking about after all. But in this situation, there was no local bidding. Why? Because while the pilot program was underway, Taser acquired a company that managed digital evidence. Philly happened to use that system, and Taser made it so that only Taser cameras could download the system's updates. Here's Philadelphia's first deputy managing director, Brian Abernathy.
And we admit that they were very calculating in their approach.
But Peter Austin Orang has another way of describing Taser buying the digital evidence company. He runs Wolfcom, which also makes body cameras.
This is what Taser does. They try to get a customer stuck into their system.
He said he wanted to make the city an offer better than Taser's, but never got a chance to.
The citizens of Philadelphia will pay their tax dollars. They hire these people to run the city and to wisely spend their money, not to give business without a bid to a friend.
Taser's actually officially changed its name to Axon after the company's most popular body camera. Here's spokesman Steve Tuttle on acquiring the digital evidence firm to expand its cloud storage product called Evidence.com.
We're always looking for opportunities. This is how you do business. You have to seize the day.
For the company formerly known as Taser, it has paid off. It sold nearly 85% more body cameras last year compared to 2015. That's $65 million in sales. There are nearly 50 other companies that make body cameras, but the Taser company has cornered the market. Some of their strategies have courted controversy. They've coached cities on how to work around government contracting rules to win no-bid deals. They've flown city officials for all-expense-paid trips to conferences and to their facilities. In Philly, actually, they offered to pay for the city's technology department to come to Seattle for a facility tour, but the city declined. Axon spokesman Tuttle says that wasn't an attempt to lobby the city.
There's no influence on that side. It's information gathering and sharing knowledge.
Sitting in his office in City Hall, Brian Abernathy emphasizes that lobbying efforts did not influence the $12 million deal.
I've never met a Taser official, first of all. And this was my decision.
City Integrity Chief Ellen Madelman Kaplan says had she heard about any shady offers, the Taser company would not have landed the deal.
Nobody came to me and said, Taser wants to take me to dinner or drive or take me to the Super Bowl. That didn't happen.
Independent contracting consultant Mike Purdy says Philly's not alone in finding creative ways around competitive bidding.
Government agencies do it in order to save themselves time.
He says sometimes common bidding rules can get in the way of quickly fulfilling a political promise. In this case, Mayor Jim Kenney's pledge to have citywide body cameras. Philly got the body cameras for $400 apiece. Each camera's accessories and supportive hardware, though, cost thousands more. And the annual cost of storing all the footage they capture, at least $60,000 a year. Hard to say whether or not that's a good deal, but Abernathy insists that it is.
We are very good at penny pinching in order to get the best product that we can, and I think that's what we've done.
Under the plan, 500 additional Philly cops will get cameras every 6 months until all patrol officers have them. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump is set to declare the opioid crisis a national emergency, based in part on recommendations from his Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis, headed by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Let's learn more with Lilo Stanton of NJ Spotlight. Lilo Stanton, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. Glad to be here.
Do we have a sense of what President Trump will declare tomorrow?
He indicated last week that there was going to be a major announcement on the issue of opioid addiction. And everybody has been reporting since then that what that means is he's going to assign some form of an emergency order relating to addiction.
What potential forms would that action take?
Well, an emergency order, and they've been done in different states. I guess about a half dozen states have, including Maryland and Massachusetts and Virginia, have created statewide states of emergencies around this. And it's essentially a device to free up public resources and to allow more flexibility in how you spend and allocate your money and your services. Chris Christie did a similar thing in New Jersey. His was actually a public health crisis declaration. It was an executive order, which is the same format that the other governors have used and that President Trump is likely to use.
Should the president declare a national emergency? One question comes to mind. When then would that emergency be declared over?
And I think that's a great question you raise, because this would be a very unique use of this kind of an executive order. In the past, they have been used for more short-lived disasters, if you will. But it also gets at this sort of critical underlying issue, which came up in an interview that former Congressman Patrick Kennedy did with the Washington Post. He described some of the tension on the commission. He's also a commission member on this task force. And he described how many of the proposals that they have in their, at least in their draft report, which will be finished up this week, conflict on a basic level with some of the goals of the Trump administration. For example, to cut the spending in government, cut healthcare spending or reduce healthcare spending. Well, that becomes problematic if you're trying to combat an addiction epidemic that requires more resources.
The Christie administration is in its sunset, and he has not acquitted himself for the longest time now in the court of public opinion. To what extent does he look at this work regarding the opioid crisis as part of his potential legacy?
I think he does. I mean, I think it's clear from his behavior. And he's also been very clear. I mean, I think sometimes people confuse this as a sort of recent issue for him. I think the governor has been a member. He served on a board of a treatment facility for, I think, nearly two decades. So this is something he's been involved with on some level for a long time. Why he waited until the end of his administration to make this, you know, the front and center priority, I don't know. But I also feel like, legacy or not, hopefully it's an improvement, you know, for the state and for the people there.
The opioid crisis is so pervasive that virtually everyone knows someone or some family that's been affected by it. And as such, has the crisis also touched the Christie family?
Absolutely. He talks about a college friend, a very close friend who graduated and had sort of what everybody might view as the perfect life with, you know, a wife and a family and a good job and eventually suffered problems with addiction and ended up dying alone in a hotel room with a bottle of vodka and a, you know, bottle of pills. And this was days after I think he was scheduled to meet Christie for a dinner that didn't happen. So that definitely touched the governor, and he speaks about that frequently.
Lilo, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Lilo Stanton of NJ Spotlight. Superstorm Sandy is notorious for the devastation it inflicted upon many Jersey Shore communities. It also flooded out many small towns along the Delaware Bay. As we approach the five-year anniversary of Sandy, WHYY's Mary Cummings Jordan tells us how the storm has permanently changed towns along the bay.
On a recent autumn day, we made a return visit to Bay Point, New Jersey, a community along the Delaware Bay, far removed from the hustle of modern life, marked by the sounds of rustling phragmites grasses and water lapping at the shore. A row of pilings lines the bayside, some still supporting empty homes which sport large orange numbers, marking them for demolition. Sandy dealt this tiny bayfront community a nearly lethal blow. Most of the few dozen properties along the bay and nearby creek will be torn down this winter. Just a few residents are choosing to stay. Irwin Shepherd was Lawrence Township mayor 5 years ago. He says this means the loss of about $1 million worth of property tax revenue and more.
It's significant because this is our only bayfront community in the township. And there was a lot of economic activity in the town because they came in and went to the local restaurant, the local convenience store, all those people that were coming for the weekends. So that's been a little bit of a loss.
When we were last in Bay Point a few years ago, the marina was still operating, a local gathering spot for crabbing, surf fishing, and striped bass tournaments. It's little more than a boat launch and a pile of greenish rubble now. Bay Point is the latest loss, but the locals could tell you of Moore's Beach, Seabreeze, and Thompson's Beach, all hit by challenging storms in recent decades. All are pretty much gone. Megan Wren is a longtime resident of Money Island, another community battered by Sandy. Wren says when it comes to help from the state, location matters.
The treatment that the Bayshore communities are getting is very, very different than the Atlantic coastal communities that are racking in a lot of tourism funds. And so we definitely get a lot less attention, a lot less funding, and I believe they'd, you know, the big they would be happier to see us all gone.
Fawn McGee is director of the state's Blue Acres program, which buys up properties from people willing to move to higher ground. She says there have been more than 1,000 flood events in New Jersey since the mid-90s, and that the Delaware Bayshore area is particularly vulnerable to flooding and storm surge. McGee says the state doesn't ask residents to leave. They choose to sell, and the queries from the Bayshore keep coming.
As much as they may not want to move away from this area, they recognize how vulnerable it is. And so we're here to help. There's money, so we'll continue to do it.
Once properties are demolished, McGee says the goal is to restore a healthy ecosystem open to nature lovers.
Because it will be owned by the state and offer public access, we are hopeful that we create healthy natural habitats for shorebirds and our horseshoe crabs, and we have the opportunity for the public to get out and to enjoy that natural area.
Meantime, Megan Wren says one half of the village of Money Island has been sold and is awaiting demolition. Money Island is the primary landing spot for the Delaware Bay oyster industry. To her, the idea this little piece of Bayshore paradise will shrink is wrenching.
It'll have a very different feel. It won't feel like a village. It'll feel like we're living in an outpost. I've spoken to a number of people who are just devastated that, you know, they had moved here, retired here, planned to make their forever home, and they're feeling as though they don't have any choice but to sell now because the whole community is kind of picking up and leaving, and it's not going to be the way they had thought it would be.
The plan is to restore much of the Bayshore to natural wetlands, which can absorb floodwaters. But Wren says there is still a need for people who are passionate about the area to live here.
If you just cut it off from human interaction and divorce it from its heritage and the culture of people appreciating it, you're not going to have people taking care of it.
And Wren is enthusiastic about efforts to restore areas of the bay. The Living Shoreline Project, funded by various sources, implements natural protections like spartina grasses and oyster castles, which poke out of the bay at low tide.
So you see oysters there growing that's trying to build kind of an oyster reef that will protect the road and help the marsh build, because the marsh isn't going to build as much if the water is aggressively hitting against it. And the oyster reef helps to block attenuates the wave action.
And all this benefits local wildlife, including purple martins, ospreys, horseshoe crabs, red knots, and the bald eagle we saw soaring above the Bayshore.
It's a really amazing place. And, you know, we're caretakers of that. People can come from all over to come and experience this. There aren't that many places that you can go in this metropolitan region where you're looking at something that looks exactly as it did when the Lenape were here 10,000 years ago. It really gets under your skin. It's a place that is difficult to imagine leaving once you've got a spot here.
Mary Cummings Jordan, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Tomorrow evening, we'll take up Monument Lab, a project that's including residents in the selection of who and what Philadelphia should memorialize with public art. Though in this age of computers and online communication, they want citizens to engage in person, talking to researchers and handwriting their ideas during trips to the park. We'll hear about this return to the personal touch in data collection on tomorrow's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.